from Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
Our young people are shaming the adult world to recall that the principal rights among all those that we hold inalienable in this nation are the rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. These rights have been denied 6-year-olds in Newton and 14-year-olds in Parkland.
It is a disgrace that 4 months after 58 people were murdered in Las Vegas, that at the national level and at the Illinois state level, there is not a ban on bump stocks. What in the world?
I cannot support a bill that makes millions of our constituents felons. That is inappropriate.
I'm not resigning. I'm moving forward. I'm working with this particular issue, and we're going to work our way through it. And we're going to provide good, strong leadership, as I've done for several years.
House Speaker Michael Madigan says he's not going anywhere, even as some Democrats are calling for him to at least relinquish his role as head of the Democratic Party of Illinois. And the gun debate comes to Springfield. We heard from legislators, gun control advocates at a rally, and Chicago Cardinal Blaise Supich, who came to Springfield to lobby for stricter gun laws. We'll talk about that and more this week on State Week. I'm Brian Mackey in the Illinois Capitol. Sean Crawford is away. In studio on the campus of the University of Illinois Springfield is Charlie Wheeler. He's director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield and a longtime State House reporter and observer. And with me in the State House Bureau of Illinois Public Radio is Monique Garcia, who covers the Illinois Capitol for the Chicago Tribune. Monique, thanks for being here.
I'm happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
So, Monique, let's start with the gun debate. Obviously, this follows the tragic shooting in Parkland, Florida, a couple of weeks ago. We've seen a lot of discussion nationwide, and this week in Illinois, we began to see some action, some actual debate and votes on gun legislation.
Right. On Wednesday, we saw hundreds of gun control advocates really kind of descend upon the Capitol. We had groups of mothers who have lost children to gun violence. Like you said, we had the Cardinal. But we also had some leaders from the Chicago Police Department who recently lost a commander who was shot and killed a few weeks ago, responding to a call at the Thompson Center. So we've seen really Democrats, particularly in the state, want to take up this issue, an issue that had long been stalled and that they had first started to consider in the fall after the shooting in Las Vegas. They had attempted to do a bump stock ban back then. These are the devices that you put on guns that accelerate the rate of fire. There was some talk about renewing this gun shop licensing bill, but that all stalled last fall. We actually saw those pieces of legislation move out of the House this week. And in case of licensing gun shops, that bill went to the governor's desk.
Yeah, and let's come back to where the governor is on some of this stuff. But so some of the other ideas that we've heard discussed would be like a complete ban on, you know, these so-called assault weapons. These are the military-style rifles that have greater firepower or designed for killing. I mean, that is not the sort of thing that actually, in terms of completely banning that did not pass.
No, that did not pass this week. That's something that Democrats have talked about for years. Former Governor Pat Quinn tried to write it into a bill when they passed concealed carry several years ago. But the measures that they did put in place put in restrictions on who can buy these so-called assault weapons. So,
is it there also a waiting period if you want to buy one? You can't just go in, plunk down your money, and walk out the door with one?
Correct. There's now a 72-hour waiting period.
Or there would be
under
if
this,
it, if
there would be
law.
Under this bill. Correct. There's a 72-hour waiting period, which is similar to what's already there for handguns. And there would also be a restriction on age. You'd have to be 21 in order to buy these weapons.
And that's become an issue here. We've seen just in this past week, Dick's Sporting Goods and Walmart, which who knew, are, you know, some of the biggest gun dealers in the country, both of them saying that they're not going to sell some of these weapons to people under age 21 anymore. Charlie, you've been watching Illinois government for a long time and seen gun debates rise and fall over the years. What did you think of what was happening in the Capitol this week?
Well, from my perspective, I think some of these proposals that have been put forward are just common sense. For example, why should someone be able to buy a military-style weapon without there being a waiting period similar to buying a handgun? Or why should youngsters, 18 years old, be allowed to buy a military-style weapon when they're not allowed to drink alcohol? So those make sense. And licensing gun dealers is probably a good idea, too, because there's federal regulation, but it doesn't become really effective because not everybody gets inspected. And there's a lot of evidence that suggests things fall through the cracks. There was a fascinating piece in the Trib, your paper, Monique, a couple days ago, tracing the odyssey of the weapon that killed Commander Bauer, starting from a gun shop up in Wisconsin, and how it was sold to a friend of the person who bought it, then it was put online and bought through the internet. And it's just amazing how this stuff happens. So I think these are common sense measures. And one of the arguments that I thought was, you know, one of the most far-fetched was someone saying, this is a Second Amendment right. It's in the Constitution. We should not limit rights based on people's age. And so I'm thinking to myself, okay, would it be fine for my 10-year-old granddaughter to go in and buy a gun?
I'm sure there are people who probably think it would be. And I mean, guns, you know, there is a tradition certainly in the hunting world of giving, you know, young people, getting them started with that sort of thing at a much younger age. But obviously we're
semi-automatic weapons.
We're talking about different categories of weapons. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But one of the arguments that was put forth by Republicans who were opposed to some of these bills is that in Illinois, to have a gun, you have to have a FOID card and you have to be 21 in order to qualify for that card unless you have parental permission. So there was some folks who said that they didn't believe that these changes would really do all that much to restrict access to these kind of weapons.
I wonder, Monique, about the politics of this, right? We've seen in the past, conservative Democrats from downstate who have either softened or blocked or obstructed some of these efforts to do gun control. But now a lot of those Democrats have been voted out of the legislature, in part because of Governor Rauner's efforts. I'm thinking of State Senator Gary Forby from Southern Illinois. I wondered, you know, are we seeing this? Is this the result of, I mean, obviously there's the national change in conversation that's happening in the past couple of weeks, but is this a more liberal, has the Democratic Party, do you sense a change in Illinois in terms of their willingness to do these things?
Well, I think it's notable that there were several Democrats who still voted against this bill, and there were several Republicans who voted for it. Gun restrictions in Illinois often fall more along a regional line than strictly a political line. So you did see some crossover that makes it hard to kind of categorize everybody in one broad stroke. But I do think the political implications will be interesting for Governor Rauner. This bill, the gun dealer licensing bill, it did go to his desk this week. It passed the Senate last year. So it's a matter now of what he's going to do with it. And he doesn't have to act for a couple months now, so he has some time to think. It could buy him some time to get past the primary election later this month, particularly when conservative Republican State House Representative Jeannie Ives, she voted against this bill and has called on him not to sign it.
Yeah, and this is sort of he has been out there, he's been asked about this, where do you stand on these various measures? I think that, if I have it right, he has come out in favor of the ban on bump stocks.
He's come out in favor broadly of a ban on bump stocks.
Yeah,
correct.
Right. Maybe not this one.
They won't speak to the specifics of the legislation that passed the House this week.
And they're not. And this is pretty typical. But they're not speaking to any of these specifics. They say we need to review the bill, even though this gun dealer licensing bill, for example, has been out there in some form or another for years now.
Right. Well, the governor has tried to avoid weighing in on this.
Did Don Harmon say he's been pushing this for like 15 years?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So yeah. It's not a brand new idea. The regionalism is interesting because the majority of the Republicans in the Illinois General Assembly are from districts that are outside the metro Chicago area. They're what we would refer to as downstate districts, where all or most of the voters live outside the six-county northeastern Illinois region. And the majority of the Democratic caucus in both chambers comes from people who live in the suburbs. So it's sort of a total turnaround. And as you guys said, losing people like Forbee or Bradley, Phelps, the people who were the mainstays of Southern Illinois politics for many, many years, they and their predecessors, has shifted the complexion of the Democratic Party more to the left, because you don't have these socially conservative Democrats from Southern Illinois that you used to have when agriculture and industry, not agriculture, mining and industry was more prominent, and there were more blue-collar union jobs available, and therefore more people who tended to be Democratic.
Well, we're going to continue following the gun debate. It's not over yet. As we said, only one of these bills is actually on the governor's desk. The rest of them are still working their way through the legislature.
Can I add one other thing?
Yeah,
about
no, please.
That?
Go ahead, Charlie. Yeah.
If Rauner were to veto the licensing bill, chances are that would be the end of it, because it did not receive enough votes in either the Senate or the House to survive a veto for an override. On the other hand, the ban on bump stocks is now in the Senate, having passed the House with more than enough votes. It's got 83 affirmative votes. Only 71 are needed for an override, and I'm suspecting it'll have similar support in the Senate, so that in a sense what the governor does on that bill is probably not going to be as significant in the long run. Same thing with the 72-hour waiting period. It had more than enough votes to clear an override.
You make an interesting point about the threshold at which the licensing bill passed, because there is a movement among conservatives and among gun rights groups to really put pressure on the governor to make sure that he vetoes that bill. But they'll also note that the governor is not always predictable when it comes to these social issues. He is a hunter, but they point to his signature on legislation to expand abortion, which he initially had opposed and said he wouldn't sign. And Jeannie Ives, when we talked to her after the vote, she said, you know, how can we really know what the governor is going to say or what the governor is going to do? Because what he says and what he does don't always align.
Yeah, well, and now until March 20th, he's playing to the sort of conservative, more probably greater share of his base is, you know, our NRA members or sympathizers at least. And after, assuming he wins the primary election against Representative Ives, then he's going to be doing what he did last election cycle, which is tacking to the middle and, you know, trying to appeal to the broad mass of people, presumably including, you know, the moms who are rallying in Springfield for gun control this week.
Yeah, and as Monique pointed out, he doesn't have to act on this bill until well after the primary. Probably not until 6 weeks after the primary.
Although it seems one of the sad, unfortunate realities we have in America right now is that there will probably be another reminder and another incident to bring this issue back into public consciousness again. We're going to leave that topic there. There was a case in Washington this week at the Supreme Court of the United States, but it started here in Illinois. It's called Janus versus AFSCME. Mark Janus is an Illinois state employee, a child welfare investigator, you'd say. And he is a member, or I shouldn't say, he's in a bargaining unit where his wages and benefits and so forth are negotiated by AFSCME, but he doesn't apparently like the idea of having to join AFSCME. Under longtime court precedent and state law, he has to pay what's called a fair share fee. It's not quite as much as full union dues, but it's some amount, and it's supposed to cover the services that AFSCME provides to everybody in the bargaining unit, whether they're in the union or not, like, you know, negotiating wages, handling grievances. This case, Monique, it started with Governor Rauner. He was thrown out, and now it was in Washington at the Supreme Court this week.
Right. So back when the governor first came into office, he issued an executive order kind of trying to go after these fees. He later filed suit on this with the goal of getting it to the Supreme Court. He was kicked off. Janus was put on because the governor is not actually a union member. So the governor went to Washington today, or on Monday, to watch the arguments before the Supreme Court. He has been very clear that he believes that these fees amount to bribes. He says that there's no way to separate the political work that unions do from their bargaining work. And he says it's a corrupt system that has driven up the cost of state government. And he's really hoping to get these struck down, which would be a huge blow to unions who rely on this money to bargain and also for other operations.
Although it is, I believe, you know, and I guess we can have a people can be suspicious about how fungible money is and whether this money is really used for one thing or another. But I mean, this money cannot be used for like donating to political candidates,
correct,
which the unions also
correct
do.
By law, that is not supposed to be allowed. Though
right
the governor says, how do you ensure that there's really a firewall between those actions?
Right. Well, so Monique kind of made the case there, for what the governor's case is about, you know, the sort of freedom. And this is really a free speech case here, right? This is Mark Janus says, I'm sort of being compelled. And we know this current U.S. Supreme Court in Washington has says money is speech, basically. He's saying, I don't want to be compelled to do it. But Charlie, this is part of also a broader effort to undermine one of the key fundraising sources of the Democratic Party. And this is not the first time this issue has come before the U.S. Supreme Court.
Oh, no, this has been around for a long time. And from my perspective, and full disclosure, as I've said on the show many times, I'm a lifetime member of the Chicago Newspaper Guild. So I'm a union guy. I also belong to our union here at the university. So I come in with the fundamental belief that unions are good, unlike people in the plutocracy who think unions are bad because they stand in the way of employers, owners, equity investors being able to grab all the money they can at the expense of the workers. Now, that's my editorial comment. On this particular one, it's interesting because most of the donations, campaign donations made by unions go to Democrats. So if there were a way to destroy public employee unions, not just AFSCME, which represents, I think, the largest number of state workers of any union, but also the teachers' unions, the Chicago Teachers Union, or the Illinois Education Association, this would drive down significantly the money that might be available to fund Democratic operations. And the thing that strikes me, in fairness, if Mark Janus and others don't want to pay the union anything, then they also should not be able to count on the union if there's a grievance against them or if there's some disciplinary matter where a union lawyer will step in to defend them. They should be on their own. They should be allowed then to negotiate their own wages, negotiate their own health care benefits, their own pension rights, all the stuff that unions do for members by law that they're required to do. I don't sense that in this Janus case there's any representation by the plaintiffs that if we don't have to pay the dues, then we'll also forego all the services that the union offers. To me, that would be the fair thing to do.
Well, yeah. So without getting too much into the details of collective bargaining law here, Charlie, Local 150, which is a very active, politically and legally active union here in Illinois, they represent, it's part of the Operating Engineers Union, and they have many thousands of employees, but some relatively small share, a couple thousand employees are state workers, and they have filed a lawsuit against the state of Illinois. And they're sort of thinking, okay, if the Supreme, you know, they're kind of anticipating that they're going to lose this Janus case. Because one thing we haven't said is a very similar case was teed up before the U.S. Supreme Court several years ago, but then it was argued, and then I think within a month or so, Justice Scalia died, and the court ended up splitting 4-4. And there are people who think that, you know, one of the big reasons that Merrick Garland never really got a spot or a hearing in the Senate is that, people wanted a conservative to get that Scalia seat for this case and for other cases, but especially for this case, which is something that they thought they have a real chance of winning and could really change the funding landscape for the Democratic Party. But, setting that aside, Local 150 sees here an opportunity, they think, that if the court really rules that everything a union does is free speech, well, then they can start bringing their own free speech cases. And they've already started filing lawsuits. They've got one against a suburb for how they're spending, money. They've started demanding from the state municipal pension fund to find out where how they're spending money. And they have sued the Rauner administration, the state of Illinois, really, to say that they don't want to have to provide those very services you were talking about, Charlie. They don't want to give up exclusive representation, which is where, you know, they set the wages for everybody in the bargaining unit. But they're saying we shouldn't have to give these sort of extras, the legal representation, the grievance handling, things like that. I mean, this case has just been filed about a week ago. We're in the very early stages, but Local 150 is asserting that they will try to sow some chaos in labor law after this happens. So you're listening to State Week. Our panel this week is Charlie Wheeler and the Chicago Tribune's Monique Garcia. I'm Brian Mackey. I guess I could also add there we're going to expect that decision until summer sometime. Usually the big cases don't come down until June. Let's turn now, though, back to Springfield. House Speaker Michael Madigan held a news conference this week, Monique, where he it was pretty extraordinary, I think, where he outlined released what did he call it, an internal review of harassment, discrimination, and retaliation cases.
Correct. So the speaker has really been under fire the last several weeks after there were two instances of senior members of his political staff being let go or being asked to leave the organization because of allegations of sexual harassment and then also bullying. And a lot of lawmakers had questions about how he's handled this process, what kind of independent oversight needs to be put in place. And so on Wednesday, he had an hours-long closed-door meeting with members of the Democratic caucus where he laid it all out for them. Before he gave this list to reporters, he gave it to lawmakers, and Democrats really had, from what I understand, a very heated conversation about these. And so what this list is a summary of nine different cases that he says has been brought to senior staff's attention in the last 5 years. There's not a whole lot of details in this. They kind of lay out somebody complaining, but they don't list names, they don't list dates, and they say that is because they want to protect victims who've come forward to lodge complaints. But for some folks, this has raised more questions because there's also a lot of exclusions on this list. We don't yet have an idea of lawmakers complaining about each other. We don't have an idea of lobbyists complaining about lawmakers. And then we're told that there are these unresolved complaints that are still kind of floating out there. So a lot of Democrats have said this is a good start to try to be a little more transparent about this process, but that it's not enough and that we really need to look at how to overhaul the entire culture of how politics operate in Springfield to protect people from harassment and from retaliation.
And I read the list and I see a certain irony in it that people are saying, well, you should give all the names, all the details, all the dates. And yet, if you can believe what Madigan said, a lot of the people who complained did not want publicity. They wanted it to be kept confidential. They just wanted some action, some resolution. And to me, there's another irony, too, that people are complaining that Madigan has not released everything. On the other hand, what have we got from the other three caucuses?
Sure,
the Senate Democrats, the House Republicans, the Senate Republicans, nothing. They say, we're not going to release anything because it's all private and confidential.
Yeah, the Speaker actually sent a letter to the other caucuses as well as all of the constitutional officers encouraging them to release a similar review of cases to let people know where they stand. I've heard from some of the other caucuses who've made it clear that they have absolutely no intention of doing that. And they argue privately that they think that this letter or this summary from the speaker could actually have a chilling effect from people who want to make complaints but don't want their names out there. The speaker's attorney noted that on his staff, this is government staff only, that there are only 250 employees at any given time. And so if you read these summaries, you might be able to figure out who some of these folks are. And there are some real concerns among other caucuses about violating people's privacy. That said, as you noted, Charlie, there's also concerns that these things are being swept under the rug and aren't being handled properly. And so it's a real balancing act of how do you protect women and men who want to come forward with complaints while still ensuring that there is a complete and full investigatory process and that people are held responsible for their actions.
And as you've pointed out, Charlie, in the past, and we've only got about a minute here before we get to our notes from the field, but it seems unlikely that House Democrats are the only people in government in Illinois that have a problem with harassment and bullying behavior.
Yeah, it's more likely that I'll be the starting pitcher for the Cubs on opening day.
Well,
in all the time that I covered government, and this is, well, I guess now a generation ago, it was pretty clear to me that the offensive people, the misogynists, the predators, didn't exclusively wear one party label or another. There were bad actors in both chambers, in the executive branch, both parties.
All right, we're going to have to leave that there. Let's go now to our notes from the field. We've got pretty luxurious, about 25 seconds each. Monique Garcia.
The Illinois Senate this week approved legislation that would put a question on the November ballot asking voters whether or not recreational marijuana should be legalized and taxed for those over the age of 21. It's only an advisory question, so it would still require legislative action, but they said that it's important to survey the public as they consider various bills to put this in place.
Charlie Wheeler.
Well, the Flash Index from the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois System rose again in February for the second straight month. It's up to 104.6 from 104.4 in January. And J. Fred Geertz, who compiles the index for the university, has been doing it for decades now, says it's the highest level for this indicator of the Illinois' economic condition since May of 2017. So the bottom line is that our economy keeps chugging along, probably reflecting the continuing strong national economy, according to the professor.
And I just want to make note of a bill that is advancing. It passed a House committee, though not without some controversy, that would ban tackle football for children under the age of 12. There's, as we continue to get evidence about chronic traumatic brain disease that relates to repeated blows to the head. Research is suggesting that young age range, 8 to 13, is really critical for brain development. So the bill is, you know, still advancing. There's still some controversy. There's some opponents out there, but it is working its way through the legislature. And a very unique sight at a committee hearing of a child-sized dummy wearing a football kit and being repeatedly beaten, sort of helmet-to-helmet contact. So I guess really graphic illustration of the potential dangers of playing football for youth. That's all the time we have for State Week this week. I want to thank our panel, which included Charlie Wheeler and Monique Garcia of the Chicago Tribune. You can get a podcast of this show at nprillinois.org or on the NPR One app. Production assistance for today's program was provided by Bob Meyer. I'm Brian Mackey.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capital by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.